This is Charlotte Frascona. I'm interviewing Jack Ledinsky on October 20th, 2004, as part of the Oral History Project for the Industrial Relations Research Institute. Jack, my first question is, could you tell me a little bit about your academic and professional background, where you did your undergraduate and graduate work?
Yes, I did my undergraduate work at the University of Missouri at Columbia. I went there after a year at Harris Teachers College in St. Louis, which had a two-year program, as many of the tech colleges do today. And after 1 year, I went to the university. I graduated there and went into service in Korea, and then came back and finished a master's degree at Missouri Columbia. Then went to Michigan for my PhD in sociology. The master's was in sociology, and my undergraduate education ended up in education. Social science education, simply because I had jumped around so much, I took the easy route of finding a way out. And it was fun because I could practice teaching with handicapped in the hospital.
Hmm.
So that's the academic background. Came to Wisconsin in 61. Before I had completed my dissertation, which was a study of attorneys in Detroit, and finished the dissertation after my first year here. I think it was just a few years after that I became affiliated with the Industrial Relations Institute.
That was going to be my next question. What was the nature of your association with the Institute?
I had developed an interest in mainly occupations and work. And I was teaching the sociology of occupations and professions, American society, sociology of work. And the IR looked like a natural link for research interests and the kinds of things that were going on at the time. In the early days, I did get IR students, graduate students, of course, in my courses. There were never many. It was an option. And I never had many of the students in the courses. They were essentially undergraduate courses, which they could take. But these students essentially wanted graduate courses. So these were options that a small number opted for.
Were you on institute committees?
Yes, I served on just about all of them. The executive committee, various committees for targeted areas. And as you recall, I spent a lot of time with the graduate student selection.
The master's admissions.
Right.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
I did that for a lot of years.
Was the sociology department encouraging of your connections with the Institute?
My sense over the years was that it was never seen as important, nor was it seen as a deficiency or a deficit. It was almost a neutral. It was okay. The only time sociology became interested is when it could increase the possibility of recruitment of faculty with a joint appointment. And IR almost always said yes, because, as you know, one of the essential problems, even back in the 70s, was faculty commitment to industrial relations and its courses. I think the Achilles heel of the program always was faculty affiliation, and I think its ultimate demise was a deficiency of faculty affiliation. Among the other problems, there was a long history of why it went into recession and demise, but I think if you were to point to critical areas, faculty affiliation really diminished as you got into the 80s and 90s.
So there were fewer people with joint appointments, or
correct,
fewer people with any interest at all?
Both.
Okay.
If they had any interest at all, they would get a joint appointment.
Mm.
And sometimes the joint appointments didn't lead to much. If they taught a course or they were on a committee, they weren't very visible or important. That was true of a number of sociologists over the years, too.
Did you ever have a joint appointment, or were you always 100% in Soc?
Always 100% in Soc. I had a joint appointment in the law school, too. I taught over there in sociology of law for a number of years, and they gave me a non-budgeted joint appointment.
Mm.
So you get listed in the staff directory as sociology and law, but it was not a major commitment by the department.
So whenever you wanted to do anything for industrial relations, like serve on the master's admissions, you know, chair the master's admissions committee, that was on top of everything you were doing in sociology.
That's correct. And it wasn't, look, all the department would care about is, did you teach the courses, did you serve on the department's committees, and did you do your research? And probably in reverse order, did you do your research?
You're right.
And was your teaching okay? You didn't have to be a superstar as long as you didn't scare students away.
Mm-hmm.
So departments, and I think it's true of other departments, that they didn't say don't do it, unless they felt you were an assistant professor and overwhelming yourself with too much outside work that could diminish the possibilities of tenure.
So why was IR interesting to you, given what you just said?
I saw it as a program for graduate students that could provide what students could not get in the business school or in LNS departments at the graduate level, that from my research and reading was critically important in both the labor movement and the corporate sector. There were overlaps with what the business school did, but in reality, most of the support of IR came from business school appointments. In the early days, not to the particular liking of the dean in the school of business, but as the years went by, it became more institutionalized that a good number of the faculty there would teach courses in industrial relations. I mean, they were mainly human resource development faculty who came over to play a prominent role in the curriculum in industrial relations. I think it is still true that there is a substantial need for not just masters and PhDs in industrial relations, both for industry and labor, but also for government at the state level and at the federal level, that provide you with personnel who have resources that they aren't going to get in an MBA.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to get the vista, the perspective that they would get in an industrial relations program. And I don't believe that's changed. I think what's changed is where the priorities of the universities are and where the priorities of government are. they have not been sympathetic to funding industrial relations programs. Not true just here, it's true nationally. Even in places like Berkeley, where industrial relations under people like Clark Kerr have become institutionalized, they still have not prevailed. They don't have visibility. They just continue to go on. Cornell the same way. They're not prominent on the state or national scene. And they're not prominent in academia. They just are there. Whereas here, it was folded.
You said that priorities have changed in terms of the government and also universities. What is important now? If it's not IR, what kinds of things have taken top priority?
Well, when you look at where the research money is, from National Institute of Health and National Research Foundations, and even private foundations, this whole area of corporate labor is not a priority. They're funding basic research in sociology, if you want to call it basic, or in the biological medical sciences. This whole arena of human relations has low priority. It's essentially a view that this area is taking care of itself, and there's not a great demand for it.
What's basic research in sociology?
Good question. Demography, population is one aspect of it.
Quantitative studies?
I would say in general quantitative studies, although there are some elements even today of case studies that yield pretty good stuff. Almost all of sociology has turned quantitative. It would be hard to find a department that has held out with qualitative research. As I say, case study research or urban qualitative studies do exist, but no department puts its eggs just in that basket. Departments have to go quantitative. If they are to survive with faculty that get money, because the money is going to come from qualitative research proposals, disproportionate to the quantitative research proposal, disproportionate to the qualitative ones. They simply aren't going. There's no funding for that. Now, National Science Foundation won't say that it doesn't fund that, but if you look at the results, it doesn't fund that.
Yeah.
Or it funds it extremely rarely. And the same in NIH or NIMH. They fund essentially quantitative studies. And there's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong is the lopsidedness of it. There's very little commitment. And the qualitative area itself is splintered. So that you have in sociology case study people, or ethnomethodology as it's called, research. And while it's done okay, it's never become as prominent. It's not an equal partner with quantitative research.
Mm.
It's like quantitative research is science, and this stuff is less than that.
Too fuzzy.
Yeah, fuzzy stuff.
And industrial relations falls into that kind of fuzzy group because it's not focusing on hard data, or
I think historically it did not. It is clear that the separation here between economics and the industrial relations faculty was a qualitative, quantitative distinction. John R. Commons simply did not do statistical studies. He may have used data, but it was secondary to the larger picture of institutional economics. And economics took a twist very similar to sociology, but more intensely away from qualitative studies to econometric analysis. And I think it's safe to say, essentially Ed Young said this at the 50th anniversary, that the economic shift, the economics department shift, going back a good number of years, was the essential reason for the need for an industrial relations institute. Mm-hmm. It had to find a home because there was no home, or there would no longer, when this faculty retired and passed away, there would no longer be a link. And I think Barbash was the last link. Mm-hmm. It's not that they dropped, they dumped you if you were qualitative. You had tenure. They couldn't dump you. Right. But they weren't hiring to replace you.
Right. But if IRRI was going to be a home for people who did qualitative research, it would have needed to have tenure granting authority so it could hire those folks by themselves, because Econ wasn't going to hire them to replace the Glenn Keynes and the Lee Hansons, right?
Well, that's correct. And are the Casalos and the others.
Mm-hmm.
That was the paradox. And I think hindsight would suggest that in its initial movement to an institute, it was not well thought through. As I look back on the whole thing, what has always been the case, going all the way back to John R. Commons and that original group, is they had a mission, and they never thought about creating an entity that had market value in the academy. Because you're absolutely right, from its inception, industrial relations had an Achilles heel. It was not a department, nor was it capable of making tenure track appointments. It didn't have a budget. And those early thinkers simply didn't see that as a problem, because they had so many people around them, they could congregate in the institute and do the graduate program. That was their vision.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't think about the business end of it, or the strategic planning, or
that's correct. If they did strategic planning, it was how to develop a PhD program on top of the master's, and how to keep the research going, not how to make yourself valuable. They thought they were valuable to the university.
It went without saying.
It went without saying, but yeah. They didn't pay attention to the basic economics and marketing of what it takes to become a value to the university. For example, after we were refused for maybe the second or third time departmental status, because people in the university, the relevant committee, simply didn't see the value of that, and the university was gun-shy about making more programs into departments, because even as late as Irv Shane's chancellorship, and he came out of chemistry, mind you, the university and its committees at the chancellor's level and at the dean's level were very chary of adding more departments. They saw an enormous pressure from African American studies, women's studies, Hispanic studies, And they said, my God, we can't make all of them departments. That takes money. That takes resources.
All the marginalized groups, all the ghettos on campus
exactly.
wanted to live up on the hill.
Exactly. And I believe hindsight will show that they very much worried about that, and improperly. And that had they allowed 1,000 flowers to bloom, even with modest funding, IR would have been alive, women's studies would be a department. The only one that was able to leverage itself because of the politics of, because of black politics, was African American studies.
Right, but they still don't have a PhD program, right?
Correct, but they're a department.
Right.
They have tenure track appointments.
Yeah.
And so it was clear to me that the administration was not reconciled to that. They saw it as an enormous drain on diminishing budgets. At the same time, industrial relations still didn't see the need to try and build its marketability. Jim Jones and I argued in the executive committee on more than one occasion after the last refusal for departmental status that one way to wedge your way in was to start teaching an undergraduate program. Nobody'd stop you. Or start offering undergraduate courses. We could have put together a course called Industrial Relations in America for undergraduates that would have included 5 to 7 modules with 5 to 7 people, getting nothing for it, doing 2 weeks. I did that.
Would this have been a certificate program?
Do what you want with it. You start these things incrementally. First you offer a course that your faculty are willing to offer, that each one does 2 weeks.
Mm.
And you call it Industrial Relations in America. And you do a little history, and you do a little labor, and you do a little human research, you do it all.
But don't you need divisional approval to create new courses?
Easy to get.
Mm.
That would have been easy to get.
Mm. Or use a special topics number.
And then you use a special topics number until it grows enough to get its own number. Then you say, okay, now we got this course. Let's do a certificate. Let's offer 30 credits, which would have easily been done across departments. You get 300 to 500 certificate students. The dean and the chancellor cannot turn you away. They have to pay attention when there's that much interest. And I do believe we would have had the interest. I know it can be done. I did it. That's how I developed the criminal justice program and the behavioral science and law program. When I retired, they couldn't dump either one of those programs because there was much too much demand. They couldn't say no. They had to find someone to replace me. No one wanted it. There were a lot of problems in keeping both programs going. It ain't easy to do it that route. But you've got institutionalized status that you're marketable. The university can't say no to you. You're of too much value to too many undergraduates. And you've got, by the way, a graduate program already.
Mm.
But the other members of the executive committee were just like the original group. They didn't see that as a way to go. It was not going to yield much. Their eye was still on the graduate program in research.
So they were looking at a bigger, bigger piece of pie, bigger piece of fruit or whatever. They wanted departmental status and tenure. And you were saying that,
things
would follow.
They keep saying no. So take another route to get there.
So you were saying, let's start a grassroots kind of thing and start small and work our way up.
My experience was, you want to become legitimate, go the undergraduate route. That doesn't mean you drop what you got, but you go the undergraduate route. You muster faculty to support a start course, and you build from there. Would it have been easy? No. But it was clear we were not going to get departmental status on the basis of research in a graduate program. Mm. Even, ironically, even one of the top graduate programs in the country. I mean, we were, by any reasonable rating, the third best department for graduate students in industrial relations in the nation. And it wasn't based on the history of the program. It was based on what we were doing when I was getting graduate students into the program. There was a huge demand for it. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we made some other mistakes. I think we catered too much to foreign students and not enough to American students. As you will recall, I did everything I could to admit minority students, particularly African Americans and Latino, who, by any reasonable standard, didn't meet the criteria. And they were always members of that admissions committee who were against it. And they were, as you'd expect, from important departments where they didn't have to dip down, or they didn't see it reasonably important to dip down. They didn't believe in affirmative action at that level. But I can tell you that our success in it was so great that the corporate world was dying for our students because they needed minorities who were well trained. Here's what really goes on, and it puts all this talk about affirmative action and its demise too, by the way, as a silly argument. It's very clear. You bring in a student that's got a lot of potential but didn't have the grades, didn't have the right schools, couldn't pass the exams, the graduate exams to get in, and you make exceptions and you get them in the program and they mix with other students in the program and they are socialized into what it is to be an academic because they are learning what they never learned in high school or in college because they were only with minority people. But they're mixing with a wide range of students and they're in classes and they're having trouble and they get help from the advisor and they get help from the other students. You will recall, we never had complaints from the American students about minority students. Their complaints was that they had to help the foreign students too much because they couldn't understand the lectures. And we took some measures because there was a lot of things going on with the foreign students. One was Formosa, they were buying the TOEFL. And so we started calling them. Even when Sally was here, we started calling them to see if they could speak English on the phone. And what I began to see is that the minority students, which were a good number, weren't going to learn a lot from the foreign students. They were going to learn a lot from the American students, the white American students, who cared a lot about them, who socialized them, who helped them to see it. And they didn't have to graduate with a straight A record. They could have B minuses. Westinghouse couldn't care less. Mm-hmm. And they went on to have fantastic careers in the corporate and labor sector.
And they would come back and recruit.
Exactly. So that's real affirmative action. That's what it's all about. And that's what the demise of affirmative action is all about, because it suggests that by making these exceptions for these students, we're denying white American students admission. Bullshit. We never had to do that. If we could admit even marginal white students and never have too many. Only in a few years did we get complaints that there were too many in the classes, in the required classes. Mm. So we never had to compromise. Look, you could let American white students in at the marginal level too. And they'll do fine, too. I mean, it's never perfect. Mm-hmm. It's like expecting everybody you put into a program, like everyone who comes as an undergraduate here, will make it. They aren't all going to make it. Our prediction is not that perfect. But we did a remarkable job at hiring, at recruiting, admitting, and producing graduates, both among foreign students, white students, American minority students, who went on to do big things in academia, in the corporate world, in labor movements, and so on. So for us, none of that was a problem.
You mentioned that when industrial relations was trying to get departmental status, it was competing with a lot of the area studies programs and women's studies and so on. And African-American studies was the only one that made it. Do you think part of the problem that industrial relations faced was that it was offering a professional master's program that people might look down on, that it wasn't a master's on the way to getting a PhD?
I don't think that was a consideration of the chancellor, the deans, and those committees mm-hmm. that had to pass on it. They were reacting to a number of factors. One, money was a problem, as it was when the business school that wanted to take over industrial relations as a last resort had to have some money, and the provost said no, the money won't be forthcoming. So IR could not survive even in that affiliated status with the business school. That money was a problem. Money became a problem by the 1980s. But secondly, IR never was seen as a superstar program that should get special status. There was no lobby for it. Women's studies had a lobby. Mm-hmm. There were women faculty all over campus who were lobbying for it. African American studies had a lobby, even if it was a white lobby, because we felt we should be doing that. So there was a constituency within the academy that fought for these programs. Now, they didn't win everything, but they won a lot. There was no natural lobby. We were invisible.
Why was that, though? Why were there not faculty saying, this is an important area of study and it's not being done anyplace else?
There were, but they were only people within industrial relations who were ready to make that argument. Mm-hmm. The others were marginal. They were joint appointments with departments that maybe the person taught a course, maybe the person didn't. Mm-hmm. And they were assistant professors. The only ones that spoke in favor of it were the hard hitters in the center of the program. And we just didn't carry enough weight. Mm-hmm. I mean, even a Jack Barbash couldn't carry enough weight. And Jack was revered. But there was another element that created a schism. You had to school for workers. And they weren't about to argue so strongly for IR that it could jeopardize their status.
But they're not teaching, they're not a degree granting.
That's right, and they were an extension. And they came over here for the teaching, they had joint appointments in IR. But it was sitting out there as the thing for labor, and they taught courses to existing labor operatives mm-hmm. in these sessions that they bring them in for short courses. So while some of that faculty in the School for Workers were ex-students and were favorable to IR, they were seen as a separate program, and why do you need this one and that one too? Because the committees that had to make decisions were looking at where to put their money, And neither the School for Workers nor IR had any visible importance in a constituency that could argue for it that was widespread across the university. And there was one from engineering. Engineering wasn't going to argue for it. The med school wasn't going to argue for it. The departments couldn't care less because they only had one person or two people. The only program that had a lot of people was the business school. And dean after dean over there in the early days never saw it as something more than they have to put up with because their faculty want to do it.
So it never reached critical mass.
It never reached critical mass, never reached visibility. And, you know, those early guys were very visible in state government. I mean, these were the folks who created some of the programs, unemployment compensation, played a major role in Social Security, but they passed away, and the legacy sat with industrial relations with a whole new cycle of people, very good people, but appointments in economics, and not visible on the national scene, not visible in the policy relevance that was going on. I mean, the national politics was changing. You had Eisenhower years, and then you had Republican presidents who couldn't care less about a lot of this stuff. So, and Jimmy Carter wasn't there long enough to make any difference. So, the world had changed around us. And we didn't see the need to try and build from the bottom. It never materialized as something useful to do. Jim and I would bring it up at executive committee meetings, but it couldn't go, it never went anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well,
now, I can't claim that it would have worked, mm-hmm. but it was among the few solutions that had a chance of working.
Well, you mentioned that you taught a lot of undergrad courses and that focused on sociology and work, but you typically did not get IR grad students in those classes.
That's true.
But there would have been a lot of interest among the undergrads.
Oh, absolutely. Those were I never had trouble recruiting students in those courses. And I would get graduate students from social work and other departments, but not a lot from IR.
Yeah. Well, assuming you were one of the few advocates for the program, what did you see as its strengths? What was it doing that's not being done now without an institute?
It was creating an alternative to the business school, which became more and more of an MBA type program. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what was happening in the business school is that its strength was in its undergraduate program. It tried to develop a faculty that was heavy into research so they could go PhD. That's what business faculty want to do. They want to train graduate students. They tolerate the undergraduate program. And the tragedy of the business school, in my view, is that it had one of the best undergraduate programs in the nation. It was in the top 10. And it insisted on using its resources more and more for the MBA because the MBA became the thing. The Harvard MBA, we had to have the Midwest MBA. And the reality was that the business school could not recruit quality students to an MBA program because on the one hand it had Minnesota up above us and the University of Chicago, both of which were far better programs at the MBA level than ours. But the faculty absolutely insisted you had to have it because you're nobody on the national scene if you don't have an MBA program. So they put more and more emphasis on the MBA. That meant that the industrial relations master's was a far better diversified program that would provide you with not just human relations in industry, but a capacity to understand labor and also to be of value to the corporate sector. And the business school was moving more and more and more towards corporate management in its MBA emphasis.
Well, also my understanding is that unionization in the private sector has diminished substantially in the past 40, 50 years. And so...
That didn't help.
Yeah, that...
That didn't help IR didn't, programs.
Yeah. There's less need for corporations to hire people who had an understanding of collective
bargaining. And there was less need and money for the unions to hire staff who had master's or PhDs.
Yeah.
So that hurt. That nationally, that hurt.
On this campus, do you think the Teaching Assistants Association and the strike in the 70s and the strike in the 80s had an effect on the UW administration's attitude toward this institute?
If it did, it was momentary. It passed. It is true that a substantial part of the leadership were IR students. They were good at it. And that became visible inside the university. But I don't think it had a lasting effect. I think it passed like the whole movement.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if this institute had just been a thorn in the side of the administration for a long time and it was looking for an excuse to get rid of it.
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think it never, as you put it, never reached a critical mass of attention with a lobby behind it as the years went by. And chancellors like Irv Shane were hard-nosed, and deans like the previous dean,
Phil Certain,
not
the
Phil.
One before him,
they
Crawford Young,
Cronin,
Dean Cronin, Dave Cronin,
Dave Cronin, and Irv Shane were hard-nosed administrators that watched their dollars very carefully, and they put their money where they saw the future. For example, Cronin did a remarkable job of computerizing L&S. I mean, what you wouldn't know today how important that was. He put tons of money into computerizing departments. Irv Shane was stuck with how many of these institutes was he going to let grow to departments, and he was tough-minded on where to draw lines. I had a run-in with both Cronin and Shane over the criminal justice and behavioral science and law programs. When we wanted to start the behavioral science law undergraduate major as a non-departmental major, Cronin said no, and Shane said no. We were young, aggressive, assistant professors. We took it to the LNS faculty. And they voted yes, just like they voted yes on Afro-American studies and yes on all the other stuff. So you had the administration saying, oh my God, not another one. And the faculty saying, go, go, go for it. So we got that program started. And I'll tell you how tough Cronin was. Years later, when behavioral science and law no longer had Russell Sage money, we were filthy with money in the early days. I couldn't give it out fast enough. I couldn't find enough students to support. Mm-hmm. We had tons of money. Those days disappeared very quickly. But when we started spending out the Russell Sage money, and I went to Cronin and said, we're going to need some support, he reminded me that we agreed when we got the program started that we wouldn't take more than 30 students, and it would be self-supporting. And he said no. Now, I managed to get the money anyway, but I had to go to lesser people who sat on money and I won't say who there were because they were in LNS and they did it anyway, even though Cronin said no. So we got it, but it was a little bit here and a little bit there, and slowly it grew. Mm-hmm. But that's how you do it. Incrementalism is the name of the game, and that's what IR was never ready to build incrementally from the bottom up.
There was something else I was going to ask you, and it disappeared. I know what I was going to ask. Why do departments cost so much more than an institute? I mean, if you can have, say, an institute for environmental studies or an institute for industrial relations, why not a department? Why is there, if budgets are tight, what makes a department cost more?
A department hires faculty on a tenure track, and they become more and more expensive the longer they're here. Institutes don't have that ability to hire. They've got to use faculty to have tenure track in a department. And institutes in general tend to solicit outside funding, which brings money into the university rather than draining it on tenure track appointments.
So they're more soft money grants?
They tend to be more soft money operations.
Oh, okay. But if you were hiring, if you had a department and a department instead of a department and an institute, and this department were hiring faculty that cost money, presumably you wouldn't be just adding on numbers of faculty. You might have fewer people in this department to balance, because you're having more in this department that's no longer an institute, right?
Right.
So wouldn't the numbers of faculty remain the same?
No.
Or the money would remain the same?
No, because in an institute such as IR, you were drawing upon faculty that are already being paid. All you did was have a course. A course is a lot cheaper than a tenure track point. And it was not a zero-sum game. Every department would add faculty. And what drives departments is demand for their services. And so they build faculty based on arguments at the dean level that they need an additional faculty or two in XYZ areas because of demand for graduate programs and undergraduate courses. And they get it or they don't get it based on their arguments. And the university tends to be a lopsided operation because you have departments that grew in an earlier period, take Portuguese and Italian or something like that. And there's very little demand for their services today because the world has changed and people aren't taking those courses. They're not doing that language. Or Russian. They're not doing those languages. It's hard to kill a department that has few students, graduate and undergraduates, in their courses. It's hard to kill it. It's institutionalized. Their faculty are tenured. It's very hard to kill it. So deans and chancellors know once you start something, you ain't going to get rid of it. Mm. Institutes, you got no obligations to continuing them. Departments really are concrete.
Right.
You can't get rid of it. I mean, it is very hard to reduce their budgets just because the number of students go down.
Mm.
Now, there's a reckoning at some point, but it's agony. The name of the game really is, once you're in, you're very difficult to get rid of. So you don't start departments lightly. I understand that. So what you got to do is build a demand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we never could get across Jim Jones saw it, I saw it, a few others saw it, but we could never marshal enough support. It would have been hard. It would have been a lot of work. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of time I spent creating a course on law and society in the law school that only law professors taught for undergraduates. I'm retired since 99, and the course is still going because the faculty who teach it and get nothing for it except pride in the law school, and the undergraduate demand for the course are sufficient to keep it going. The demand is there for it.
That's interesting. I mean, supply and demand is an absolute basic tenet of economics, and you would think that people who are trained in economics would have taken that as a given, that they needed
to. You would think so. You would think, all right, with that basic premise, you look for ways to increase your demand. Well, they did it, but at the graduate level. Mm. And you get to the point where you have too many students and not enough resources and faculty to cover it. And the premise on which the IR faculty went is that, oh, they'll give it to us if the students are there. Wrong. Mm. Graduate programs in an institute in austere times do not get the resources. Undergraduates will, because they're here to stay. Graduate programs are a whole different thing. And so to increase your demand at the graduate is not the same as increasing at the undergraduate level.
Well, also, if you've got the undergrads, you're starting a pipeline.
Exactly. It trickles upward.
Yeah.
So the thought was, if you keep increasing, you know, we do a great job with minorities, we place them well, we have large numbers, we're rated great nationally. Didn't matter. In austere times, it didn't matter. When there was competition from other institutes and programs that wanted that same status, you had problems.
Yeah.
You needed a lobby, a constituency to make it work. And as I said, women had, there was a clear lobby there. There was a clear lobby for Afro-American studies.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lobby. I mean, even Hispanics didn't have a lobby for a while. Slowly it grew, and they did a lot of protesting. Well, IR people didn't protest. The only protests that happened were the students, either during the Vietnam War or for the teaching union, the teaching assistance union.
Mm. There's been a little bit of protest recently on the part of a group whose acronym is SLAC, and it's the Student Labor Action Coalition. It's a group of students who tend to be interested in global issues, sweatshop issues. You know, they're the folks who had a sit-in at Bascom when David Ward was chancellor, concerned about Bucky Badger ware being made in overseas.
Correct,
sweatshops.
Yes.
But there hasn't been any sort of vocal protest among the students about the demise of this institute.
Right. It was invisible to them because they had no courses.
Right.
We weren't teaching
it. A lot of people don't know that it exists.
They didn't know it existed to the undergrad. But I'll tell you, it is exactly those students that would have taken the undergraduate courses.
Right.
If we offered a course in global labor problems or global corporate issues to undergraduates, not just that constituency that was worried about labor conditions in these factories in Vietnam and Korea and China, where all of the clothes and caps and stuff and sneakers were being made, but a ton of other students who care about that but aren't involved politically would have been in those courses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these were the cutting edge courses. So political science offered one, econ offered something close to it, and those courses fill.
Mm-hmm.
Sociology never did. Well, it did some of it, but mostly at the graduate level.
There were a couple efforts to save the Institute. One was, there was talk about moving it to the business school. Another one was talk about moving it to La Follette. Can you think of other things that might have been done to preserve the Institute?
Those were the two prominent ones. And again, La Follette never showed a sufficient amount of interest to make it possible. They saw themselves as already weak enough that they didn't need to take this on.
Even though they became their own school?
Even though they became their own school, it's not a whiz-bang, highly visible operation within the university. It's there and they're doing okay.
Mm.
And by the way, they're very dependent upon departments for their faculty. So La Follette, it seemed to me, never saw this as something they wanted to. I mean, their faculty were jointly appointed here, so some of them might be in economics and La Follette and IR, or political science, La Follette and IR, but they never saw themselves as taking on this as a big issue, particularly if there's no resources. What it came to is it didn't matter where you went, it was going to take resources. And that is exactly why IR was not viable, because there were no resources. So how the hell can you send it to La Follette or to the business school without resources?
Mm-hmm.
And if the provost says there's no resources for it, it's dead in the water, unrevivable, wherever you want to go. I mean, you could have talked about the med school or anything, but everyone who took it on would want resources.
Right. Nobody was willing to take it on and support it by themselves.
No one could. Realistically, they couldn't. I mean, we were in austere times.
Even the business school?
The business school would have had a hard time doing it financially. I mean, look, it's one thing to get Granger to give you a building and then to give you more money so you can tear down the old bank building and increase the size of it. The business school, its growth has been in the MBA and in the executive, corporate executive programs. So you got that Fluno Center. What they have dropped is the IR type of consideration, and they let the undergraduate program basically go to hell. The name of the game today is not just MBA programs, but you got to have these executive programs which gain you a huge amount of money. Now, I don't know how well they're doing with the executive program. They got this beautiful building for the executive program that costs a fortune if you want to have lunch there. I don't know how well they're doing, but my guess would be that they suffer from the same programmatic issues that they suffered and continue to suffer with the MBA. If you're a corporation and you have an opportunity to do an executive program, why would you go here instead of the University of Chicago, or maybe the Harvard program, or the MIT program, or even the Minnesota program, which is better than ours, at least in the ratings? Why would you come here? So I don't know their finances, but I'll bet you they're locals. The problem that the business school faced in its original MBA program was twofold. One, the only students they were able to get into it were students that graduated from the undergraduate program and couldn't find a job, so they figured, what the hell, I might as well get an MBA. Okay, that's one problem. Secondly, they offered courses that essentially were joint with the undergraduate course for the MBA program. And the reality is, I can tell you, because I knew students in it, the undergraduates were setting the curve, not the MBA students. So what does that tell you about the quality of the MBA students they had? Now, has it changed now? I don't know. I haven't been in this business for a lot of years, but I was on the evaluation committee for the business school, and we essentially told the business school, after looking at all this, one, keep your undergraduate program going. Two, drop the emphasis in some of your graduate programs for the MBA and just stick to the ones that are strong, like the real estate one and a few others, and quit investing all this money in hiring faculty to do this when the courses they're teaching, the curve's being set by the undergraduates. So I don't know if they've survived in a different way. They got enough alums, they can get a big building. But I want to tell you something. A fancy building does not a program make. MIT is still stuck with dumpy old buildings in their MBA program, and it shines because of the faculty and the students they can recruit. That's what makes a program, not buildings. Buildings are useful, but not the ultimate critical element. And the same thing is true here. You can build a Granger Hall, doesn't mean the programs increase in quality or the number of students can increase. Just means you got room for things you couldn't do before in the way of lunches and banquets and conferences, but that doesn't make for a quality program. Same with the Fluno stuff. That's not what makes a quality program.
What would have made this a quality program that the university would have been unable to shut down?
A wraparound program that offered an undergraduate major, a master's, and a PhD. I could be wrong. I think there were a lot of risks involved, but a wraparound program that had a substantial number of undergraduates, I mean, let's say you could get 100, 200, 300. I mean, my criminal justice program that's still going, we don't have enough resources to take care of all the students that want to get in. We got waiting lists for the summer internships. Just imagine if we were able to offer an IR internship to undergraduates. That makes you valuable. You got 300 people that want into the program, and then you're offering a master's and a PhD, and you are allowed slowly, incrementally, to hire faculty. If you can't do that, you're dead in the water. You've got to be able to hire faculty. You cannot be, on the long run, you cannot be dependent upon other departments for your courses. That's the Achilles heel of the behavioral science and law program. Yes, there's 300 students in it. Yes, there's an advisor. Yes, there's someone who looks over it and the criminal justice program. So it's institutionalized to that extent in LNS. But the struggle is constantly to get those courses taught. How many decades do you keep doing that? When the world is changing around you, and the course you want taught, like law and society, which is offered in sociology, oops, the guy who taught it left. And nope, there's nobody in the department to teach it. And oops, we don't even have a course we can substitute for it. What do you do? Ultimately, if you have not got the capacity to hire, you have no long-term stability. You need tenure-track hiring capability in the long run. And we were never given that. So that's the easy, quick answer to what I think was the fundamental flaw. But when you start asking, why did we never get to that point? Because the world changed around us and we didn't market ourselves properly to develop a constituency that the university couldn't say no to, because that's what it's all about. Art Hovey, you know Art, he's retired. He was the advisor to more than one chancellor. And Art is an expert in, has written a book on the university's architecture and its development. And Art is giving a talk to the, on Monday, to the UW Retirement Association's luncheon meetings. Mm-hmm. So we have Alan Fish to talk about the East Campus development at lunch. And I got Art to talk in the morning. And the title of Art's presentation is, If They Come, You Will Build It. And his argument is essentially that this university grew because the demand for students to come here meant that somebody had to come up with the money to put up some buildings for these students to be in. And even in the worst times, when the students' demand was there, you built it. What you did is you built awful stuff, like this building. You know, you can call this, Art calls this kind of architecture, and the humanities building is the new brutalism. But if they come, you will build it. So the same is true of departments and programs. If they come, you will build it. If there's a constituency, you will build it. But the proviso is that if it's just at the graduate level and you're invisible without a constituency, you can't build.
That's interesting. I would have thought that in a huge research institution like this, that grad students would be the priority, not undergrads.
The bread and butter at this university is the undergraduate program. The regents and the legislators love the publicity for graduates who get Nobel awards and so on, but what their constituencies bitch about is that their kids can't get in the university as an undergraduate. That's the bottom line.
I pay taxes in this state, my kids should be able to go here.
Right. Yeah. And that's what legislators, and the legislature in this state has always been a fine tuner of what the university does. It won't leave it alone. And when our dear Governor Lucy created a Board of Regents for the entire system, it did only one thing: denigrate the powerfulness of this university to have the capacity to build without the competition of the other campuses. He did that with the best of intentions, but it backfired on this university. It became very clear that we would not, we could be the diamond in the system, but Eau Claire was still there. Stevens Point was still there. They're all there, and they have to be attended to. And so you got a legislature that worries about the undergraduates in this system. And you got a system not like Michigan, where there's two boards of regents, one for East Lansing and the other university, other colleges, and the University of Michigan. It shines. Even in bad times, it shines compared to what we get. Mm-hmm. I think that the overall devaluation of the University of Wisconsin at Madison over time is in no small part directly related to a single board of regents.
Interesting.
And everything else flows from that. Now, it is true that universities throughout the country, public universities, have moved more and more towards external funding and foundations like ours to get alumni money to build. It's true. But ours is even worse because of the board of regents. So we're handicapped even more by legislative concerns about how are they going to get enough money to cover all the whole system. We're just one star in the system. A bright star, but by virtue of the functionality of it, we're competing. Michigan, yeah, it competes, but not at the same level.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you very much.